Welcome, everybody. It's wonderful to see you at this event. My name's David Toombs. I'm the Howard Patterson Chair of Theology and Public Issues. We're absolutely delighted to be hosting this event with friends and colleagues in Arusha, who are hosting Peter Harris's visit to New Zealand. Very grateful to Andrew Shepherd for taking the initiative. Andrew is co-director of Arusha, and also very pleased that Selwyn is involved, and he's just got a couple of notices about upcoming Arusha events here. So Selwyn, can I pass over to you at this point?
Thank you, David. Right, Arusha Dunedin began in 2011, but then went into recess for 2 or 3 years. We've been working again this year, and we operate in two ways. We've entered into a partnership with Tirahunga Camp. Some of you will know Tirahunga Camp. It's on the far side of the Tairi Plain, belongs to the Presbyterian Church, and it's used by schools and youth groups just all the time. So by this partnership with Tirahunga Camp, we're introducing a lot of people to ideas about creation care and restoration and that kind of thing. So every second month through the winter, we have been gathering out at Tirahunga Camp and engaged in restoration planting of some of the old pasture land and more recently of the stream. And as you know, a lot of New Zealand streams are in need of loving care. So we're glad to contribute to that and to the restoration of the stream. We're going to be out there this coming Saturday at 11 o'clock, and the Harrises will be with us for some of that time. If you've not joined us before, you'd be very welcome to do so. It's always interesting, and it's a lot of fun, and you feel like you've done something useful by the time the day is over. To get to Tirahunga, just follow State Highway 1 until you get to East Tairi. Turn right into Rickerton Road and go right across the Tairi Plain. And when you get to the bottom of the hill on the other side, turn left. And a little way along, you will see the sign that says Tirahunga Camp on your right. The other thing actually is going to happen before that, and that is tomorrow night, an extended and relaxed opportunity to meet with Peter and Miranda. We're having a potluck tea up at Leith Valley Church in Malvern Street. I think if you're a Dunedin person, you'll know how to find Malvern Street. Just keep going up and up and up, well up there. Leith Valley Church is on the left, and we're going to gather at 6 o'clock. It's going to be very informal, but it will be an opportunity to spend more time with the Harrises and catch up a bit more on Arusha around the world. So I haven't handed a piece of paper around for people to put contact information on, but if you come to either of those events and you're new to us, we'd love to keep in touch. Alternatively, I suppose you could write on there. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Owen. Another quick commercial. Our next event is a Humanities Division panel discussion on the US election. What happened? What next? That's next Thursday, 1st of December, from noon to 1:15. You're most welcome at that open and public event. But turning to this evening, it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Reverend Peter Harris, Anglican minister and conservationist, well-known, co-founder and president of Arusha, a Christian environmental conservation organization that currently works in 20 countries around the world. Peter graduated from Emmanuel College, Cambridge University, in English Literature and Theology, and then worked as an English teacher at Christ Hospital before serving as an Anglican minister near Liverpool. Alongside national colleagues, he established Arusha's Portuguese and French field studies, working on field projects for 25 years, during which time he took up a position as an adjunct faculty member of Regent College in Vancouver, Canada, and our Sarbel Institute in Michigan, USA. He's now responsible for shaping Arusha's vision and ethos globally. Christianity Today describes Peter as a joyful environmentalist who thinks of creation care not as an onerous duty, but a natural response to the goodness of God. And he's recently been involved with the Vatican staff to promote Laudato Si, the papal encyclical, among business leaders in Latin America and elsewhere. He's also authored the book Under the Bright Wings, Kingfisher's Far, A Story of Hope for God's Earth. And that's on the table behind me, so do please look at the table on your way out. And also with Rod Wilson, the upcoming Keeping Faith in Fundraising. He's here with Miranda as part of a wider visit to New Zealand, did events earlier in the week in Wanaka. We're absolutely delighted to be welcoming you here to Dunedin, Peter, and to address us on this fabulous title, Why Theology Matters to Tree Frogs. Please welcome Peter Harris.
Thank you very much, David. I was just sighing with relief that I got tonight's title and not next week's title about the US elections. So there is a God after all. And in a way, it's a good lead-in because we really are living in extraordinary times. And there used to be a time when we were going around when I had to kind of make that point. And I suppose it's both sad and sobering that I don't think we need to make that point any longer in so many different ways. But certainly we live in politically extraordinary times. In Britain, where Miranda and I now live, after 30 years or so living out, we've come back to a country we don't recognize very well. And I honestly think I've lived through a week in which more happened politically in 1 week than has happened in my entire lifetime. You know, every day you'd get up and switch on the radio and discover something else completely without precedent had happened in the bubble that is Westminster, but which is having a big impact on the way that we think about ourselves in our part of the world. And we lived in France for 14 years and there too saw events moving extraordinarily rapidly, and my only heads up for the people talking next week is watch the French elections next year. But I want to look at the times that we're living in through three particular lenses tonight, and I want to try and do it fairly carefully. I said to David beforehand that my educational background means I'm quite comfortable with confrontation and interruption and all the rest of it, and so do feel free to ask as we go along for amplification or signal the fact that later when we get to the Q&A you'd like to disagree strongly or add something, that would be good. And the way I'd like to structure it is 35-40 minutes at this point, and then we'll have, I hope, a free-ranging discussion for 2025, if that works. Can everybody hear me? You're all okay? If you need to do your email, that's perfectly okay. Normally those seats are taken up by the emailers. So, to me, it's all right, buddy. Pulling your leg, I see the collar and assume you're happy. Yeah, you're happy to be the butt of my jokes. The stand-ups go for the front row, but the vicars, we go for the back row. You know that already. So my three lenses all begin with a K sound. I want to look at this topic of the extraordinary times through the lenses of crisis and convergence, and that Greek word, kairos, which is looking at time in terms of a particular moment or a time of opportunity, but something that's just not chronologically defined, but which is saying something is happening at this moment. So crisis and convergence and kairos. So I want, as we do it, to think about some of the possibilities for healing that there now are for many, many parts of the world, and the places that those parts of the world mean to us, not just the human communities there. Because these are places that are given into our care, and they are places that sustain us or don't sustain us. They're places which are facing conditions now that in whatever it is, 30-something years of travel, we've not seen before. And I want to think about it that way. So starting at crisis, it is fairly familiar territory, but I'll just give you a quick sort of 5,000-foot view of it. People are increasingly asserting that we live in the Anthropocene. in a time where human influence has really become the dominant point that we have to take into account as we look at our world. Miranda and I are just back with an Arosha team from the World Conservation Congress in Hawaii. So that was 10,000 people or so from 180 nations and entities, many of whom have given their lives to understanding the places that they're in. And there is essentially a widespread agreement that we are in the Anthropocene. If we want to understand our world, we have to understand people and their impact. And you see it at the popular level. Will the polar bears survive? You've probably noticed it here in the popular press, the kind of eco-angst or whatever that's going on. I don't know if any of you have seen Leonardo DiCaprio's latest film, Before the Flood. But there's a popular level of deep anxiety about this. 2 weeks ago, I was speaking in the Netherlands, and a conservation leader there told me that there's a general eco-anxiety in the Dutch population now because they go to the beautiful places they go to, but they're quiet. There's nothing much living there. And yesterday I was in this extraordinary forest, what would it be, west of Makarora. And it was a turbulent experience for me because it's the most beautiful place, but I have felt it's like a in my hometown of Salisbury, going to the cathedral for evensong, and there's just one soprano showed up. It's a silent forest, essentially, with these ecological ghosts of plants bearing witness to defense mechanisms to animals that have gone a long time ago from the place. So it's a graveyard, it's a cathedral, it's inspiring, but it has some desolation in it. And that sense of crisis, You don't have to be bright to register that, even at an emotional level. And everybody's concerned about this. I have a letter in front of me, just what three European church leaders wrote to President Sarkozy during an earlier time of political influence for him. They said, "We know that global economic growth over the past 50 years has been accompanied by accelerated environmental decline and climate stress. The financial, food and fuel crises of our times strongly suggest that the dominant economic models have their limitations when viewed in and from a global perspective. Learning to live within our planet's means is the new challenge, and we must approach it with a new sense of realism, a sense of justice, and a sober assessment of the legacy we're creating for our children's children." So, as you know, there's been a lot of talk about financial crises. I think the last big crunch was 2008. Our response has to do pretty much exactly the same, only more so. And yet, the ecological overdraft is of far greater concern than even the highly leveraged situation we're in financial terms. So, the World Wildlife Fund published their latest State of the Planet report 3 weeks ago, and like many of the estimates, they got revised upwards. Turns out, since we started Arosha, which means the rock in Portuguese, in 1983, we've lost about 50% of vertebrate life on Earth, just in that 35-40-year period of time. And their anticipation is that if we carry on the current trajectory, we're probably looking at least 60% of life on Earth. And we're not looking at particular taxa, which are really under stress, but 60 to 70% of life on Earth will have gone within the next 15 years. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. And this is, as an Argentinian philosopher friend of mine said recently, we shouldn't call this the sixth extinction, as has been known. This is the first annihilation. It's the first time we've done this to the rest of life on Earth. And that Anthropocene influence is really our doing. And that's what makes it unique. And it makes it unique because we know what we're doing. There's no debate about the data. Not really. And even in more complex scientific modeling areas like climate change, there's extraordinary consensus. And so these are crisis times. So much, so familiar. So you can talk about how did we get to this. And there are a number of theories around, and some of them are startling and some of them may be familiar to you, but I'm quite interested by Richard Lovelace, who is a church historian, who in his book, The Dynamics of Spiritual Life, made a connection that has become particularly real to us for reasons I'll explain in a minute. And this is what he said. He said that if we start to think about how our thinking about the world goes, and then we look at the dominance of Christian thinking in those Western societies, which have to a degree been exporting that, we have to ask, how did this theological crisis that makes the Christian world rather ill-equipped to deal with this, how do we get into this situation? Because you have an ecological crisis, but if you have a crisis in your human capacity to respond, you've got a bigger problem. And if honesty compels you to say that human capacity to respond was formed by some forms of Christian theology, you've got to ask, how did we end up with a theology that's so hampered in some ways addressing our ecological crisis? And for Lovelace, it goes down to this. The formula that insists that the gospel should deal with spiritual matters and not meddle with political or social affairs, the familiar fundamentalist argument for passive support of the status quo, emerged before the Civil War as a conservative evangelical defensive resistance towards or postponement of the abolition of slavery. And here you see a linkage being made between the response to slavery out of the Christian church of the time and our response to climate change and biodiversity loss in our own times. And I want to say this evening, and many of you may differ, but I am a Christian subject to the authority of Scripture myself. If you like, in some senses, it's my tribe globally that has been my issue as we in Arusha have been trying globally to work with a Christian movement to care for creation in the face of the self-evident collapse of ecosystems. And so it's with great pain that I kind of run through some of these analyses. And the thought that it was trying to keep slavery and keep Scripture that produced a theology that was so out of this place, out of this time, looking towards some other world which would obviate the need to deal with anything in this world is a deeply painful thing. Where it's become personal is that one of our leading younger leaders within the Arusha movement is an environmental historian called Jean-François Mouhot, whose academic work has been on the linkage between the response to cheap fossil fuels and the response to slavery. So his point is there is an argument that says there was moral conditions for ending slavery, but what did it was it was cheaper to burn fossil fuels. And so as we look at the question of how are we going to come to terms with the havoc that cheap fossil fuels are now wreaking on us all, we must not just expect that moral argument must do it, but we have to apply creativity to find newer economic models where, frankly, there's far more money to be made in different ways than getting cheap fossil fuels. So that's one area of analysis. There are lots of others, and you may have your theories. I'm sure Andrew will have four or five. And if we had another five-hour car journey like we've had today, I'd probably hear two of them. There are plenty of other thoughts. You could say that it's down to the Black Death in the 13th century in Europe, where theologians found their reality of losing a third of Europe's population in pretty much a decade meant that theology could no longer look at where we were, but had to start to imagine God's concern being elsewhere, because here was terrible. In our Portuguese context, where we lived for 12 years, the Great Lisbon earthquake undoubtedly shaped thinking, as did the fact that only 50% of the boats that left Lisbon in the 16th century ever came back to harbour. So you had to come to terms with suffering and with understanding God in the light of the cost of the new world. You know, there's all of these things. Yes.
Sorry, is it a signal if you want to
talk about it? Yeah, I'd be glad to.
Talk about it now, but,
no, it's good.
When you mentioned about slavery.
Yes.
When you're talking about things in the Bible does explicitly condone slavery. So
yeah.
What was the connection between when you
Yeah.
Sort of potentially every, now that fossil fuels will eventually die down, and it's predicted that within the next somewhere 35,000 days that it will go, and that obviously with that drop, fossil fuels will increase in price.
Yeah.
Because the way the Bible says that slavery is condoned and there's specific rules about how to
retain
slaves, is that implying that we may see a re-condoning of that?
Well, who won the Booker Prize this year was a very interesting novel about how slavery gets reincorporated into society. But the first exegetical point I make is that the term slavery in the New Testament does not indicate anything like what slavery turned into in that industrialization of slavery that we saw with the economic triangle. And again, Miranda and I were standing on those slave fort roofs in south of Ghana recently, and you had a different thing going on, but it's a big discussion, and I'd rather do that one with you later, one-on-one, if we could, while accepting the validity. I'm not saying, and slavery, incidentally, is far more prevalent today than it was in the days of so-called abolition in numerical terms. We have not abolished slavery, but there was a challenge to the industrialization of slavery at that point, which had two... What Jean-François would, and I'll give you his references, would argue is that there was a moral challenge from Christians in Western societies about the nature of human beings and saying this is essentially wrong. And they had to make their point over 50 years and get it done on a legal technicality. But he would say that the kind of will to abandon slavery came about because of the understanding at the US end or the American end that it was going to be cheaper to burn fossil fuels than it was to keep slaves on your plantation. But let's do that one-on-one. Thank you, though. I'm, as I say, comfortable with it. Either way, we're in a situation, globally I would argue, where Christian indifference to the creation is both a fairly recent phenomenon, but it's also particularly unfortunate. And we tend to think of it as though the Christian gospel itself has become genetically modified by a society whose DNA has really got strong strands of individualism, consumerism, and other things which really have no place in Christian thinking, but they have so found their way into Christian expression that often what we see is really a projection of the very things that are finishing the planet off. And there's some unfortunate things on the other side too. In the secular conservation world in which I live and move and have my being, there's an understanding that religion is some formalized thing, and the religious claims of consumerism and individualism are not recognized. But I think they're religious commitments which are actually causing planetary havoc. So I do sigh sometimes when there are religious leaders, and we tend to get up there as the Christians, who are summoned to give a commentary on this, but the quasi-religious groups who are promoting human well-being at the expense of people and planet are not up there as well to defend how they think that saying you have more stuff, you'll be happier, your life will have meaning, how those religious claims aren't being challenged, because they're the ones that are really rapacious in planetary terms. So the funny thing is that you would expect that that kind of consumerist gospel was more prevalent in the wealthy countries, but actually we find that's not the case. And it thrives just as much in Kenyan megaslums and Latin American barrios as it does in wealthy places. And that's a paradox as well, and a sad one too. And nevertheless, the consequences for kind of Christian leadership are pretty sad if you have that thrust coming from the Christian church. And Chris Wright, who's a missiologist and a friend, has written about the consequences of this missiology for Christian leadership. The God who commands us to disciple all nations also commands us to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God. We will struggle to relate these things to each other when we ought never to have split them apart in the first place. We need repentance and renewal in the church, as well as renewed passion for world mission. My hope is for nothing less than a 21st century reformation among evangelicals who need it as much as any other Christian bloc. for there are scandals and abuses in the worldwide evangelical community that are reminiscent of the worst features of pre-Reformation medieval church in Europe. And, you know, if you knew Chris Wright, he's an Ulsterman, softly smoking, you wouldn't pin him for a radical. But really, we are seeing this kind of soul-searching within the biblical Christian community, which I believe is absolutely needed if we're going to be in any condition to look to what's happening around us. So, on the one hand, you have a major environmental crisis. Then I would argue we have a crisis in our Christian thinking that is giving us some difficulties in coming to terms with it. But personally, I think we should take real heart, and there's extraordinary hope. And this is where I want to talk about convergence, because maybe it takes a crisis to draw people's attention to things. And there is absolutely no doubt in our minds that Christian attention is now being focused in a completely new way on the conditions of God's creation, of which we are a part, and for which we have some particular responsible role. And at the same time, the convergence comes because the environmental community of which we are part, by talking about the Anthropocene and by understanding the impacts of human life and behavior and choices, are now realizing that you don't just, as it were, fix the planet by fixing habitats and species, but the environmental crisis is a human crisis. And then as a human crisis, it automatically becomes, however you define it in some sense, a spiritual crisis. It's about our nature, our understanding, our commitments, our values, where we draw them from, what we think matters. So the convergence is that there's essential agreement that what is wrong is us. There may not be an agreement about how we got there, or even agreement about what we need to do to sort it out, but at least there's agreement that this is a human issue. And that convergence we've tracked happening through a series of World Conservation Congresses which bring together these people. The first one we went to was Bangkok in 2004, when there was really very little thought that people's beliefs had it much to do with what was happening globally. By 2008 in Barcelona, we ourselves were much more welcome into the program. There was a greater conversation going on, and it was being framed in terms of spirituality and conservation, but it was happening on the fringes of the event. And I would say that many agreed that we've got the decades of data, we have increasingly powerful legislation and policy, we've seen heroic leadership and great stories, we have wonderful media, but all the indicators are still going in the wrong way, and therefore what is actually going on. So I think that some of the questioning that we're hearing and some of the convergence would map entirely onto Christian thinking about these topics. I've just picked out one or two here. Gus Speth, who's advised many American presidents on environmental things, and I'll stop there, says, all of us who have been part of the environmental movement in the United States must now face up to a deeply troubling paradox. Our environmental organizations have grown in strength and sophistication, but the environment has continued to go downhill to the point that the prospect of a ruined planet is now very real. How could this have happened? And then the UN, another UN report said, there is a set of environmental problems for which existing measures and institutional arrangements have systematically demonstrated inadequacies. Achieving significant improvements for a long period on these problems, which emerge from the complex interaction of biological, physical, and social systems involving multiple economic sectors and broad segments of society, has been impossible, and for some, the damage may be irreversible. The search for effective policy responses to these emerging environmental problems has recently focused on options to transform their drivers. Policy debates are increasingly concerned with how to address drivers such as population, economic growth, resource consumption, globalization, and social values. And Gus Speth later sort of, I haven't got the exact quote in front of me, but he later sharpened that to saying, we knew that it was going to be about population and resource depletion and all of these things, but it's turned out it's about human selfishness and greed. And he said, we scientists don't know how to fix it. That's not something we can fix through science. And even in France, which was extraordinarily secular context to be living, when we had a big environmental debate, the Grenelle de l'Environnement, the verdict at the end in Le Figaro by the French equivalent, I guess you may know David Attenborough here, or who is your national equivalent of David Attenborough, but whoever, an environmental media rock star anyway, his verdict was, we had this debate about the environment, but we weren't allowed to talk about the human choices and values which are driving us to this point. It was off the table. So it wasn't a worthwhile debate. So you see the convergence. On the one side, we have a Christian theology that is in rapid development in places you wouldn't expect, to embrace that whatever else the good news of Christ is about, it's about everything. It's about the person, the community, and the places, creation itself. And then on the other hand, you have the convergence of an environmental movement that's saying, we have a human problem. And we've had this in multiple conversations. Achim Steiner, who until recently was head of United Nations Environment Programme, said to us over dinner that, in truth, it's about changing people if you want to do anything about the environment. He said, I'm not really supposed to say that, but it is. And he said, but what changes people? Because people have really thought that if we give them the data, if we have strong policy, if we have the educational programs in place, people go, oh yeah, of course, you know. But actually, nobody ever has. And if anything, if you look at all the graphs, they're accelerating towards crossing the planetary boundaries, or whatever those terms are you wish to use, which make life on Earth unsustainable. So here's the convergence. Now I want to say that if that convergence and at least agreement on what is the challenge has taken us somewhere closer as a sign of hope, the next sign of hope is I really do want you to be aware that something really significant is happening and has happened within Christian theology over the last 50, 60 years, which now means that we're far better able to understand the significance of Christian good news for all of that. And I could just pick out a few signs of that. We have even the World Evangelical Alliance issuing a declaration on the care of creation. The Lausanne movement, which as far as anything herds the cats of the evangelicals in anything, it would be what it is. They have said that the care of creation is a gospel issue. They've got practical ways now in different places, and we're involved in them in bringing together grassroots initiatives for mutual learning and exchange and taking things forward. We are increasingly seeing Christian leaders around the world who understand that when you look at a landscape, you're looking at a religious document. You're seeing how our choices have made it look like that. You live in a part of the world where that is so clear and obvious. Christians have been more adept at exegeting scripture, like we began to do a little bit, and not so good at exegeting landscape to say, what does that tell us about both God and ourselves and our choices? But we're seeing the habit of exegeting landscape coming into being. And to speak quite personally, we in Arosha measure a little bit what we're doing by looking at landscapes and saying, can you see Christians were there or not? If you can see it in the landscape, and I could take you to 8 places on Earth, and God willing, a seabird mountain in North Ireland in another 10 to 15 years, that you would say Christians were there. And that's why the grey-faced petrel is there, and there aren't any ferrets, and there is a vegetation that's looking like it was, and it's beginning to work again, because Christians were in that community, and Christians understood that it meant that they did something over a 40, 50-year period. By the way, that's not much, going back to my cathedral point at the beginning. Our cathedral in our local town took 200 years to build, And most of those involved in the project knew they'd never see it done. But they said, okay, goodbye, happy emailing. Really rotten of me. I'll have to send an email apology afterwards, but there you go. It was fun. The project is one of what that James Davis and Hunter has called faithful presence, I think. There's no guarantee it's going to save anything, that we're going to get this done, certainly in our times. There's no guarantee that what we see changing will not change. But there is the possibility of faithful presence, and there is the possibility of Christian hope continuing to produce very beautiful things in lots of places. And I just want to remind us that this is the biblical Christian story, that the way the Bible frames the question of whether we should care for creation is by asking, who is Jesus Christ? And what does it mean then for us to follow him as the Lord? And from the beginning of Genesis to right at the end, from the creation to the new, which is, as you know, renewed, kainos creation, that story is one of God's love reaching out to the whole of creation. Had I brought a PowerPoint tonight, which I thought would be testing the 5 o'clock slot and the warmth of the venue, you would see now a slide of Genesis chapter 9 and some highlightings, because my version of the Bible says God's covenant with Noah at the top. That's the kind of gloss from the editors of that edition. But then 7 times in the scripture it says, this is the covenant I'm making between me and all of life on earth, between every creature. It's God's covenant with the whole creation. But we've just read that scripture through the, what can I get out of this for me and my life? We've not read it for the promise to the whole of creation that actually is written from the beginning to the end of the scriptural witness. And we have in Romans chapter 8 that famous and extraordinary passage, the creation itself was subjected to futility in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the glorious freedom of the sons of God. And the word sons is retained for exegetical reasons. And probably the corruption is us. And the freedom from slavery is the freedom from the Anthropocene into whatever the good word would be for the age of the kingdom and the age of the Holy Spirit into the new creation. So the Bible really understands that anybody who follows Jesus is going to be led into relationship with God, which then renews relationship with other people and, of course, relationships with creation. And these are hopeful times, because I see that consensus within my part of the church. Much of the theology, I don't want to discourage academics, has been done. But what we really need to know is, so what? What's it going to mean in the slums of Manila, in the forests of Indonesia? What's it going to mean if you're a Christian running a palm oil plantation in Malaysia, as I know some who are? What's it going to mean in Latin America if you're looking to have forest but to have a way of not starving? And putting a theology and a missiology together like this is really, really important. We're going to come to some questions in just a moment now, but I want to give you just an illustration, I suppose, of some of this kairos and how it may be having practical effect. There was mention made of Laudato Si, this extraordinary piece of work from the Pope. Because the Roman Catholic Church has pretty much a command and control structure that many institutions would be quite grateful for, the fact that the Pope has said this is how it is with regard to economy, ecology, and justice, business leaders throughout Latin America who are practicing Roman Catholics are saying, okay, so how do I earn my living then within that framework? It's a real question. But they are determined to push through to some real answers. And reforming the way that we generate wealth so that we don't leave creation depleted is an amazing, creative, and wonderful challenge of our times, that's a Kairos opportunity. As part of my working life, when you mentioned Cambridge, when I left Cambridge, half of us went off to the City of London and did quite well, and in the era of Reaganomics and all the rest, and half of us went to save the world. And now, those of us who went to save the world have kind of come back to Britain, and the other half are still in the square mile, for the most part. And it's a good conversation now. It's a very interesting conversation, because they've drained the dregs and are very, very well aware that they're on a short plank to wealth creation if the ecological conditions no longer are going to exist. And we are very, very well aware in real terms of what that has meant for the places that we know and love. And the challenge is, if we share that biblical faith that I outlined that is a blessing to person, to community, and to planet, how then do we reform economic life such that wealth can be made without depleting creation? In the 35 years of what we've been doing, in the era of poverty relief and social justice, we've seen the heavy lifting move from philanthropy and giving to venture, philanthropic, impact investing, call it what you like, but ways of making money for investors that bring about social justice, jobs, good governance, and environmental conditions. But it's not quite so strong in there yet. But certainly that possibility for renewing society by making money has been well seen and is being well done. If you look at the mobile phone, if that had been a charitable project, still be on a shelf somewhere, you wouldn't be able to get the parts and whatever. Because people have made gazillions, mobile phones are throughout Africa, where my daughter lives in her little town up there. They can bank on her crummy little mobile, and people are genuinely economically empowered, and you're seeing tremendous social prosperity coming through those mobile phone networks. And it made a lot of people a lot of money, and, you know, good for them. What we now have to see is the same phenomenon happening, and we don't yet know how to do it, where biodiversity does not take a hit, but yet human communities really flourish and do well, and investors can see a return on their money. They may not get 20%, however, they may just, but they're not going to get 20% for much longer anyway. So that's a great blue sky challenge and a time of hope. And then I just want to give you one. I would, in a way, love to talk about your mountain, but I think I'd be intimidated. But let me give you an example from what we've done in Kenya to try and illustrate how creativity can find these solutions. And these are now scaling up globally. And I hope some of you might be able to tell me things I don't know at the end. In Kenya, the coastal forest stretched basically 4,000 kilometers from Mozambique in the south to Somalia in the north. And now we're down to about 40 kilometers only, just south of Malindi, just north of Mombasa. There's a pocket just north of Malindi, but it's basically that block. And it's called the Arabuka Sokoke Forest. And traditional conservation arguments had played out there, like saying, well, you know, there's 6 unique bird species in there. We can't afford to let them go. But the communities around that forest had their reasons for why they were continuing to chop the forest down. And it turned out through long-term Arusha presence there that this was to pay for secondary schooling, because without that, and at that point it needed paying, you would be poor forever. So it was a fairly straightforward matter to say, how can the forest generate school fees? Because people knew it was a one-way shot to chop it for carvings and charcoal, and that was on a ticking clock. But if we could find a way of keeping forest and keeping afloat for school fees, that would be great. And the answer was essentially to train people locally, provide an infrastructure, and every tourist that enters the forest to see the wonders that are there, all the fees go to school fees. And that's what we've done for 15 years. And there are 400 kids now right the way through the system, girls and boys. One or two are even working for Arusha there. The forest adjacent communities are fiercely protective of the forest and in some cases replanting. And we were there with Muslim community leaders recently who said, it's transformed our place and our lives. It has. You can find this wisdom of making sure livelihoods are safeguarded, problems are answered, and that ecological conditions are sustained. But it requires, funnily enough, the incarnation. It requires long-term presence, good listening, good understanding, and local understanding too. There's no global environmental package that's going to work, and certainly not on a three-year grant cycle. So reforming philanthropy, which is why I've written the book on fundraising, is part of the answer that we're going to need to find. So that's just one example, but we could multiply them up from many, many places. Crisis, convergence, and I think Kairos, we've chosen as our global kind of understanding of ourselves that we are involved in conservation and hope. And I really do believe there's hope. Finally, for us as Christians, it's what Richard Baucom has called, I think, ultimate hope, not penultimate hope. That's to say, I know that God will not abandon, a loving God is not going to abandon his creation. And I get out of bed every morning for the promise of that and the hope of renewal. I grieve the silent forests, the loss of species. I have a book on my shelves at home for my one and only visit beforehand, 10 years ago to New Zealand, of all the extinct species, your huge moas and that moa eagle, which I wish I had known of. And not many countries where the extinct, really? You think I would have wanted to run. But anyway, yeah, I nearly got my scalp taken off by one of your falcons 2 days ago. So I'm a hardcore raptor guy. But anyway, I just think that there is some grief here, but fundamentally, there's tremendous hope. And secular conservationists think that the hope is that the Christian church will have this change of heart and mind. If you map where biodiversity is on the planet, something less than 2% of the planet's surface, and we've done this, not that bit of biodiversity mapping, but our bit of mapping was to ask who lives there and what do they believe. Most of the time in the global south, Christians are quite significant stakeholders. So if the church has no idea about this, we've all got a problem. That's what the secular conservation world thinks. If the church, on the other hand, goes through that 21st century reformation that Chris Wright was talking about, it's going to be astonishing and the landscape will look different. And there'll be tremendous sort of joy. Conservation works. We just need about 100 times more of it, which, if you funded it, would be apparently more or less the same as the soft drinks budget of the USA. So we're not talking a lot of money. Good. Well, thank you very much for listening so attentively. Only one bold interruption. But let's throw this open for debate and question. And I'm sure in the room there are people who will know more about various topics than I do. So I'm going to make that a collective exercise too, if I may.
Thanks, Peter. That's great. We are recording this evening's lecture, so to capture the questions for the recording, and since it's a relatively manageable group, I'll bring the mic to you rather than repeat your questions. So the floor is open. Peter is welcoming questions.
Cheers. Take it. Oh, okay, cool. Thanks.
Can you tell me your name? Because I want to put a...
Ewan.
Ewan.
Yeah, I'm a third-year ecology and zoology major student here at Otago
Great.
Uni.
Thanks.
You were talking about the Christian front, but as we know, there's many different denominations within Christianity. You're Roman Catholic?
I'm an Anglican.
Anglican, right, okay.
Which kind of means I'm really hard to label.
Sure.
If I was an amphibian, I'd be super slippery.
Sure. So you were talking about how that particular sects within Christianity, perhaps maybe the evangelicals, were maybe not solely responsible, but part and parcel responsible for the particular mind frame that is causing the devastation, the egotistical or self-centered side. But if you were to talk to any other Christian denomination, they would say that you're wrong. Through exegesis, how do we identify which sect within Christianity is right?
Huh.
If we can just hold that one and maybe take one or two others and then group the three there. Two or three. I've got a question over there. Say who you are.
Kia ora, Peter. My name's Andrew. Co-director of Arosha in New Zealand. I just wanted a clarifying question around the discussion around slavery and fossil fuels. My understanding was what you were saying is that slavery was a moral argument, but fundamentally what transformed or pushed that over the line eventually was an economic reality, which is that fossil fuels were cheaper. That would suggest that ultimately what will drive, if we take that as an analogy, what will drive an awareness is that we realise that there's a moral issue around an ecological crisis, but fundamentally what we're looking for is the financial golden bullet, if I'm to take your analogy correctly. So what I'm curious is for you to flesh out if that is what you're saying and what that financial or that market reality might be.
Thanks for a really interesting talk. My name is Stephen. Just a theology economics student here, and so from that my question bears to your really interesting interplay with economic theory and how that describes the individual, so the consumer, the rational self-interested individual who always wants more is better, and your understanding, you know, I really appreciated some of what you said around that. Do we take that as a given too much, that this is the way people are, i.e. rational self-interested is how we are, rather than saying that is one narrative of how we maybe have been conditioned to be, and theology presents us with a different narrative? I'd be really interested to hear sort of some of your thoughts on that space, whether your lecture's entitled A Theology for Tree Frogs, whether it's almost also a theology for economics that speaks about tree frogs and consumption and people, and relating it to sort of what Andrew's saying there. Do we need a reformation of our economic thinking of a person and our entire economic behaviour, whether it's in relation to a golden bullet? That's sort of the question, if you can gather a few strands from that.
Yeah.
I'd really appreciate that.
He's Trinitarian, isn't he? You know, it's always, you can just tell. I didn't even look up. So let's take them one at a time. I think your question about who's right is essentially a question about the empirical method, or it's a question about whether we can know anything for sure, and if we know things for sure, how do we know them? And all I would say about that is I want to say kind of about eight things, but one of the things I think I want to say is that we've become very bad in an internet age at disagreeing with each other. And we don't even understand disagreement terribly well at the moment. And I think we've seen the political consequences of that. There are a number of reasons for this. Perhaps we only hang out intellectually and in our virtual communities with those with whom we agree. So it's always a tremendous shock to meet somebody who actually disagrees. And we don't necessarily do that very well. And one answer to that has been for people to say, well, you can't know anything anyway. But the problem with that philosophically is that's an affirmation. The fact saying you can't know anything is a statement in itself, and you don't get out of the bind. So I have a very positive posture to knowing that truth can be found, because in my theology, truth finds us. There's a personal God communicating, and that's validated epistemologically through evidence base and then personal encounter. That's a thumbnail sketch. And Christian disagreements are no different from any other and have been resolved in church history in exactly that epistemological fashion. So, in summary, retain your hope that there is truth to be found, because truth will find you. The arguments are a good thing to have. They're not the end of the world. Don't hide amongst those who will always agree with you. And, of course, I have reasons for thinking that I don't think sect is technically the right word, but if you like, my current or denomination. It isn't, funnily enough, it's not denominational, this. And Arosha is not a denominationally organized or defined organizing. We're a theologically or missiologically organized community globally. And you will find Arosha people who are Roman Catholics, who are Pentecostals, who are Anglicans, who are, you know, it doesn't cut down denominational lines. And some of the most devastating people intellectually I've met would call themselves Christians, and may well be Christians, but they just happen to think like somebody who's worse than Attila the Hun. So, you know, it's not easy to label these things. But again, we're stacking up a good post conversation, if you have time, about how truth is to be found and known within Christian Options. Your point, Andrew, about how does this thought about slavery line up, and is that necessarily that rather bleak view, the way to think about it? For me, again, this is a theological question that I don't believe we live in Christendom. That's to say, I don't think decision makers are likely, and this slightly edges into where you're going, they're not likely to instinctively think of the common good, common humanity, even in moral categories. And then there are massive actual constraints of doing it. So some of my Christian friends in the business world have inducted me into the fact that everything is measured quarterly, if you're lucky, and it may be measured weekly. So remuneration is going to be calibrated that way. And if you're slipping on your returns on investment over a quarter, you will be gone. So an ecological reality that's looking at 50 years is completely meaningless within that kind of a framework. So there are actual constraints within the way this works, and even personal. So you're a young graduate, full of idealism. You go to the city, you're put on a team, and you're given, say, 200 million to go and play with. There are four of you on the team. The other three know for a fact that if it's not 250 million at the end of the quarter, you're gone. And you're the one in the room that says, well, I'm not just going to think about the financial returns of this project. I want to think what it's going to do to this workforce that I'm about to lay off and to this place that I'm about to cut some corners with and dump stuff in their river for. And the other three look at you and as if to say, these are our jobs on the line. We're in a team of four. And you're compromising the 50 million that's going to keep us in a job. So you don't care about... do you see what I mean? These are not theoretical questions. So you'd better have a robust view of human nature if you're going to look at this. And Jean-Francois' theory is that probably, yes, if we can't find a solid economic argument for coping with climate change and biodiversity loss, and it may be just the cleanup costs or the political costs are just getting too great, then it won't be enough to say, you know what, we ought to do this. Because our economics has been formed absolutely around the idea of the autonomous individual, paradoxically, given the epistemology of the word economics and the house and the community oikos. So yes, we need a reformation of economics. Again, the problem has been that if you restrict the Christian narrative to a number of personal issues, fidelity, honesty, truth, you know, and you say it's pretty when it comes to economics, filmmaking, how you cook your food, sex, but it doesn't work in those areas. And we've had that failure of nerve from the global Christian community. If there's nobody thinking there is such a thing as a Christian economics, which Dooyeweerd and others 120 years ago were pretty confident they could find, but we've lost that, then we've got trouble. And the Pope has basically said that we have to reform economics so it joins up with a lot of other things. And its disciplinary autonomy has got to be challenged as well, because whatever. But working with economists is a whole art form, isn't it? Or a science, you know. Well, yeah. I hope you've just got your life project there. Yes.
Thank you very much,
the
man Peter.
With the mic, and then
sorry.
It's all right.
I'm Murray. I'm one of David's colleagues in the Department of Theology and Religion.
That's scary for a start. I've read your stuff, I believe.
We've met before, actually, at Regent. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, we did. There we go. Nice to see you again. Yeah. A while ago.
You mentioned about the very compelling data and flavour of human impact upon the environment and human responsibility for climate change and so on, yet there remains pretty widespread and determined resistance to that idea, including amongst Christians. And I'm wondering what your response is to those who are determined to disbelieve, for whatever reason, that our actions are actually having an impact that is having such devastating consequences.
Can I take the questions one at a time now? Because we'll start volleying rather than rallying. I wonder if you're aware of the work of Catherine Hayhoe, who is a climate scientist at Texas Tech, but a Canadian, and was one of the Nobel Prize winners when the IPCC got its award for the work. She says that there are sort of six tribes of deniers, and this is out of long experience of working in Texas as somebody who really understands climate change. And I can't remember her exact taxonomy, but she says there's a sixth tribe who essentially are contrarian or love an argument or whatever. And working within a media system where it works by argument, if you're going to have one argument, you must have a counter-argument, otherwise you're accused of bias. And also it's not interesting, as Neil Postman said, you know, his idea that public debate in a visual age has to be argument, otherwise it's just not interesting. She would say there's absolutely no point in debating anything with that sixth tribe. And interestingly, among them are no climate scientists, actually, which is telling. There are really none left in the sixth tribe. But the other five, she looks at different reasons why people get there. And so when I personally, not being a climate scientist, are faced, as happens fairly frequently in the Christian community, but not many other places, with those who say, hang on a minute, this is all, like, you know, Donald Trump's theory was cooked up by the Chinese to hamper our economy, or whatever. I feel it's very important to listen to what that's about, first of all, and where it's coming from. Rod Wilson, who you'll know very well, says, we live out of our biography and our theology. And in most personal encounters, I myself and others are speaking out of biography a lot of the time. So as a rule of thumb in discussion, I go there. Then the second thing I think is helpful is if you actually know what you're talking about. So I personally am not a climate scientist. Happily, with the internet, they can sit down and listen to climate scientists and others and make their own mind up about where they are. And we're blessed, aren't we, with ease of resources. And I'll just tell you one story. I have a leading Christian friend in the UK who was absolutely, and he's a prominent figure involved with a very other prominent figure who is an absolute climate science skeptic. And what I actually did was to say, come with me to the Royal Society and meet fellow people from your community of faith who are scientists who will tell you where we are on this as a person to person in relationship, quietly so nobody will know. So we did that. And 3 years later, I was at a meeting where he publicly said, I just want to say I have recanted from my climate. And it took time because in a previous academic life, he had made a great living out of being a contrarian and been proved to be right. So he'd known that challenging orthodoxy wasn't a bad thing to do. But on this occasion, this isn't challenging orthodoxy. This is saying gravity is merely a theory. And final personal story, my father was a colleague of Richard Doll, who discovered the link between lung cancer and smoking. And for 30 years, Richard Doll was vilified, was put down, because the British government needed the tax revenue of cigarettes. You know, this is just the same thing playing out in a new area. And there are massive interests at play, financial ones, the Koch brothers and others, who would wish to see climate change as essentially not a critical issue. But they're not exactly impartial in that their financial interests are vested in assets which could be absolutely stranded. So,
thank you. I was really just going to follow up on Andrew's comment. Some of us, I'll put Andrew and myself in the same basket here, have had a tendency to be fairly cynical about things that major on economics and wealth creation and that kind of thing. But I think if we think about the whole ecology of the earth and human well-being and all that, it's not a bad thing for us to be looking for an economics that will help people to thrive. If we take up the whole biblical thing about justice and relief for the poor and that sort of thing, looking for something that will help people to thrive is not just a cynical way of dealing with the problem. It's actually the right way of dealing with the problem.
Yes, I think God made the world to work is the first thing to say. And when I hear you can only have human prosperity or a living environment, I don't believe the conflict model. And I think we should retain hope. It's a bit like when people hear that Miranda and I are going to show up and we're environmental people, because the only model of environmental people they knew was gloomy, doomy, you know, judgmental, angry people, they think that's who's coming to my town. Because that's been environmentalism as defined without the influence of much Christian thought. The medical movement globally began with Christian understanding. So care of the dying and all kinds of things that make no economic sense are hardwired into it. Because Christians were at the birth of that. Christians were absent from the birth of the environmental movement. So the mobilizing concepts have not really reflected Christian thinking, and only belatedly is that happening. So in other words, the word environment has meant a thing. Bit the same with economics. As our friend Stephen said, economics has essentially pivoted around rational self-interest. And there are multiple examples of how it serves my personal interest to do this, but the tragedy of the commons, it doesn't serve anything else. And that's economics as we've known it. I'm just trying to raise a vision for a new economics that is shaped by the character of God, for love, for self-neighbor and creation. And it's absolutely different. We haven't seen it, we don't know it. But don't we need economists who are passionate about that vision to challenge the wealth creators and say, this is our rational economics? The interesting thing, I was in London when the Occupy movement was sitting outside St. Paul's. A lot of people I didn't expect from the high towers of finance came down to talk to everybody who was sitting outside St. Paul's in the Occupy movement, because they actually, at some deep level, shared the understanding that it's broken in different ways. The huge disappointment was everybody knew what they were against, but nobody really had much that they could put forward as, this is, have you tried doing this? Is this going to work? It wasn't done that way. And I suppose what I feel about Christian thinking at its very best and Christian theology done throughout the whole of life is that we should be able creatively to come up with some things that say, you know what, this could be great. And I have some friends doing this in Africa on investment and business and small enterprises and whatever. I can send you some websites afterwards. And it's going well. And the amount of money that's going into so-called impact investing now has gone up by, you know, exponential figures. Philanthropy isn't essentially exponentially possible in growth terms, but investment is. And we're seeing, I heard from a leading investor responsible for some, you know, billions of funding in London just 3 weeks ago. He said the bottleneck is not money for investment. We have trillions waiting on the shelf. The bottleneck is scalable projects where we can see that there will be benefits to planet and people, and we just don't have enough of them yet. And I think the Christian community is one place where that conversation could go well, because we don't say, you're in business and finance, you're the enemy. And I'm a green guy, so I'm the good guy. That's been the catastrophic error of the environmental movement.
You've got one more question from Paul.
You're looking really unhappy. Question. It's about time you got the microphone. Question. Oh, well, that was a deep sigh. Oh, deep agreement. Amen. Okay, I'm getting a free lunch ticket here.
So we got two more questions to come. Could I just see if there are any other questions in the room? We're moving towards 6:30. Okay, grand.
Thanks very much. Paul from one of David's colleagues as well. Obviously, political action and change by governments is really important in all of this. I wonder if you have any stories of Christians around the world successfully influencing government policy for the better in the sorts of directions you've been talking about, because sometimes we feel so powerless politically, but actually government action is obviously vital as well as all the other things.
Yeah. So you won't expect me to name names?
No.
Or countries?
Strategies, I guess, as Christians.
Well, I'll talk about my personal and Arosha's strategy first of all. So we're small beer, totally, and our new UK director has come to us from leading Friends of the Earth. And his point about the British government was that they're not listening to the RSPB, which has got more members than all three major political parties put together. So Arosha they're not going to listen to. So campaigning from outside the political system has its limitations anyway. And we've kind of bet the house as a very tiny organisation, and Miranda and I in our own lives and with other Arosha leaders, on the power of relationship and good disagreement within the Christian community. So we have sought out the people of peace who are politicians, who do make policy, and one or two in actually very significant positions for conversation, for hard moments together of the recognition that this is really tough, for looking at what politics, what it means to be a politician in a democracy, and particularly in an internet age, where we're living in the age of post-truth politics, actually, now. There's really, I mean, I thought Hillary Clinton's fact checker was sweet, because that was absolutely, you know, that was a sweet gesture back in the modernist times when anybody cared about what was true or not. I mean, because that's not how politics operates any longer. It operates on image and keeping the narrative. So I think all of that to say that I know some politicians who are deeply Christian and in very tough places. I could talk about one of them, Marina Silva, who was, the day she was made Minister of Environment in Brazil, she was ordained as a missionary by her church in that role. And when we met, she had 12 armed guards around her because she'd been taking on the loggers during her time as Minister of the Environment. The destruction of the Amazon rainforest really, really diminished by some, I forget the exact statistics, but really significant. She then ran for president and gave, 2 weeks before the election, she gave a tremendous fright to Dilma Rousseff. And she's a very, very brave lady with a story that has impelled her into politics. And we need to pray for people like her, because they are people with, the problem about being a politician is you get two choices. You're going to do that or that. You haven't got the option of doing the four others that journalists think might be beautiful. And you've got to make a party and bring it with you. And it's, but I would say we need to pray for and encourage the people of peace and those whose concerns do this. And as well as having policy suggestions that are, most politicians will tell you that what they're offered, don't people realize that it looks lovely, but you'd be out of power in about 3 days if you did that. So it is the art of the possible, and there's a lot of moving parts that have to come in together. And I think Christians need to do a better job of having political understanding of what the political process is like for those doing it, and come up with policy that could work. Where I take hope is, I think, again, the scripture gives us a gospel that isn't just true, but it works. It can be operationalized. We've got to recover our confidence in that. So we should have great ideas that a politician is going to like, because at the end of doing it, he's still in power, which is, you can be beautiful and outside politics and stand on the pavement with your placard, but, far better to be in the room and you're the one that's going to sign off on this or that. And you may not like either of them very much, but, So take hope. There are remarkable people, and we should pray for them. Some are believers, and some are not believers, but they really think like believers because their dad was a pastor, or because they went to Sunday school, or just because they're great human beings who God is doing something in their life.
So, final question.
I'm Ruth. You've spoken about top down and you've spoken about bottom up, but the horizontal spread of these issues is what interests me. You've spoken a little bit about Africa and some of the influences there, about France, UK. We are here, we are a Pacific nation. I think we forget it quite frequently. But the Pacific is one of the most threatened areas of the world in terms of climate change. It's also one of the more Christian areas of the world. I think there's the variety of there's a limited variety of Christian denominations across the Pacific. But I don't know how much the church has got involved in the ecological issues of the Pacific. I mean, it's a question I have. I don't know whether you can answer that, but I think, I mean, I just find in New Zealand that we forget we are a Pacific nation and we forget often about our Pacific neighbours and the threats that they're facing.
I can't... this is one of those moments where I feel I don't know enough to respond, and I'm on a learning curve, but it was interesting in Hawaii to hear the conversation about ocean spaces, that it depends how you define the size of your nation, and the Pacific nations have this extraordinary space. And as you know, the Christian churches are very present. The curious thing about the drivers within their thinking is that globalization means that they're often not terribly Pacific. So I would love to see the emergence of stronger Pacific Christian thinking for the Pacific. And that would be a great horizontal task. But your analysis, I think, is quite right, that this isn't one of the areas of the world where this is moving with the speed it really needs to for the conditions you have to live with. So biodiversity loss and climate change in terms of extreme weather events and a whole bunch of other and rising sea, you know, this is a impact zone. So the churches here need very much to, from all levels, as you said, bottom to medium to high, have their responses rising in urgency, because your impacts are going to be clearly felt far more directly than in many places in the world, which are increasingly turning into kind of fortresses like Europe, and as has been predicted, just a defensive mentality on those islands of privilege, and those are not going to be possible for your region quite clearly. But I wish I knew more, and one of the reasons I'm here and talking to people is I'm learning a lot more as I go around, and I'd be fascinated to hear what your reflections are going to
be. And can I just add, I mean, so I work with Arosha, and so some of the partners we work with, particularly people like Caritas, which is the Catholic Development Agency, does a lot of work in places like the Solomon Islands and in Kiribati around justice and in particular environmental issues. So, I mean, and that's particularly strong within the Catholic Church and within some of the more mainline denominations working in those contexts. There's probably some urgency more around reflecting about how that might work out in a New Zealand context with a strong Polynesian presence here in New Zealand churches. But there is by no means within Pacific nations is there sort of a lack of urgency on that. There are a lot of amazing young leaders, particularly involved in 350 Org and other advocacy organisations. And I've had the privilege of meeting some of the people, and they're astounding people. Yeah. So there is hope.
And that note of hope is a good one, I think, to end this evening's conversation. I think we'd all agree it's been a fascinating insight to one of the most significant issues facing Christian faith as we move forward. We value and appreciate the work that Arosha and other organisations are doing to make sure that a Christian voice is heard on this hugely important public issue. Please join me in thanking Peter Harris for his talk. Thank you.